I'm going to try this without a microphone. If somebody, you can't hear me? Okay, plenty of room in the front, guys. I'm going to talk this morning about Harold Parrott, who was a longtime sports writer and then a baseball executive in New York and then in Los Angeles. He had a long career, although mostly what he is remembered for is his book, The Lords of Baseball, which was published in 1975 and trashes about every front office person that Parrott ever worked with. But let me get going on Parrott. Parrott was born in 1909 in Brooklyn, very close Catholic family, very sharp young man. He attended St. John's University and graduated with a master's degree at the age of 20. He then went to work for the Brooklyn Eagle, despite the fact that his mother thought it was a very trashy business to be in, and her little Harold shouldn't be working in the dirty newspaper world. But he went there and was quickly a success. According to his own work, he became kind of the pet of Harris Crist, who was the managing editor of the Eagle at the time, gave him a lot of leeway and interesting assignments. And in 1938, he was named sports editor of the Eagle, despite not being 30 yet. This may have been due to the fact that he was willing to cross a picket line the year earlier when the Eagles reporters and editors were on strike. Parrott had a knack for impressing people with more power than himself. He worked out a great relationship with Taylor Spink, who gave him a lot of choice assignments for the Sporting News, helped his career quite a bit, was always coming up with cute little nicknames like the Talking Parrott and things like that. And the Spink-Parrott relationship was so close that actually in 1950, the Sporting News ran a story on its front page talking about the flying parrot because Harold Parrott had taken a plane flight, which was not exactly big news in 1950, but somehow it was judged to be worthy of the front page of the Sporting News. He also established a very close relationship with Branch Rickey. He started wearing bow ties and eventually came to the Dodgers. Rickey came to the Dodgers in the winter of 42-43, had been very unhappy with a guy named John McDonald, who was their traveling secretary and lead PR guy. And so Rickey dumped McDonald, and in January 44, Parrott joined the Dodgers as their traveling secretary. He worked for the rest of the 40s and into the early 50s with the Dodgers doing various things. Now this fella comes on the scene. This is John Collins, often called Jack. He'd been with the Dodgers since 1913. Started as one of those kids who's hired as casual labor around the ballpark. Eventually becomes an usher and a ticket taker. Eventually starts managing the ushers and the ticket takers and almost all of the non-baseball operations of the team. He oversaw the groundskeepers, the maintenance for Ebbets Field, and the ticket department. And in February of 1952, this headline hits the papers after the Dodgers are seen at the district attorney's office, and it turns out that in late 51, you'll remember the Dodgers had a certain unfortunate outcome to the pennant race. They had already been authorized to print and sell World Series tickets, which they had done. Then all of a sudden, some other team got to the World Series, and they had to return all of the tickets and the funds. And all of a sudden, $25,000 worth is missing, and they go to the DA. Frankly, they immediately announce a reorganization. Collins is going to resign. Harold Parrott, who's next, is going to become the ticket manager. That's O'Malley. The next guy is Lee Scott, who becomes the traveling secretary. Then Frank Graham Jr., who becomes the PR guy. And last, Babe Hamburger, with a wonderful name. He was kind of a general office guy for the Dodgers in the 40s and the 50s. You'll see this is actually an old newspaper photograph with the orange outlining how they had wanted the picture cropped to be used in the newspaper. This loss of funds actually was not a surprise to the upper Dodger management. When Larry McPhail was leaving, The board of directors noticed that there just wasn't quite as much in the Dodger bank accounts as they felt they should have been. One of the reasons they weren't all that unhappy that McPhail went into the Army. Ricky began noticing the same thing. And in 1947, the Dodgers hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency to look into things to find out what was wrong. I have not been able to find the Pinkerton report, but the upshot is that Arthur Mann, who is Ricky's assistant, is sent to Kentucky to talk with Commissioner Chandler and explain that they think they have a problem. Chandler recommends a North Carolina attorney named A.P. Kitchen, who's also a former FBI agent. And Kitchen comes up to Brooklyn, looks around the operation, especially the ticket department, sits down with Mann and says, "I think you've got a problem with Jack Collins." And Kitchen, in a letter to Chandler, then says, "The look on Mann's face was one of fear." So Collins clearly had something on somebody. Mann gives Kitchen a kind of temporizing response that, "Yeah, we'll handle this. Thank you very much." Kitchen goes away. The Dodgers do nothing. Now in 1952, you've got the district attorney's office involved. Things get more complicated. Collins is a very wily guy. The next day, he unresigns, comes back into the office, and O'Malley, backing off, gives him an office in order that he can work with the district attorney to solve this problem. After that, as so often in these cases, things get kind of mushy. The district attorney announces that there is enough evidence to indict, but not enough evidence to convict. So the only indictment is handed down at a very low-level ticket department employee. Lloyd's of London eventually pays the Dodgers $100,000, not $25,000 for whatever they lost. And Joe Collins moves to Florida and builds a hotel. Now, the reason I'm telling you this in the middle of the Harold Parrott story is that the person who's named to replace Collins is Harold Parrott. And Harold Parrott doesn't want the job. He cites a couple of reasons for it. The first is that he feels that he could make more money from the traveling secretary's World Series share than he could with the raise O'Malley was giving him. This is not quite true. He had been making $10,000. The raise to become the ticket manager would make him up to $12,500, and he had averaged over the 8 years he'd already been with the Dodgers about $1,700 a year in postseason play. However, writing 25 years later, Parrott said he could see that this team was so good that there were going to be more World Series shares available and he'd make more money that way. He has a talk with O'Malley about this, and O'Malley agrees that for the 52 season he will pay Parrott a World Series share if there is one, and there is. That goes ahead fine. And then in 53, Parrott comes in looking for his World Series share, and O'Malley, somewhat nastily according to Parrott, says, "What did you think, this deal was going to go on forever?" And so Parrott, from then on, these two guys didn't like each other. Parrott feels that O'Malley had welched on a deal and was a liar and totally cheap. However, the wording that Parrott provides in the book is really kind of ambiguous as to what O'Malley actually promised. And O'Malley clearly didn't fear he made a lifetime promise. The second issue that Parrott raised was that he would lose freelance writing money in this job because he wouldn't be able to travel with a team. This is somewhat interesting in the light of what John Burbridge talked about in his presentation just previous to mine. In 1947, during the Yankees, Dodgers, Chandler's fight over DeRocher's associates and all of that kind of thing, Parrott was called before the commissioner. One of the key pieces in the chain of events that led to the hearing and the suspension were some columns that were written in the Brooklyn Eagle. They were called "Leo Says," supposedly written by DeRocher, who didn't give a damn, didn't write any of the columns or anything. Parrott wrote them all. And so Chandler calls him in as part of this hearing and says, "You're fined $500 for, you know, just raising everybody's ire with these columns, And you have to choose, are you a journalist or are you a baseball executive? And Parrott at that point says, well, I'm a baseball executive. But now he's saying he's losing his freelance income. So it's a little bit hard to tell exactly what it is. The decision is made for Parrott, he says, when O'Malley goes to Mrs. Parrott and points out that Harold is going to be home all the time now to help her with the boys and be around the house, no more of this traveling. And Mrs. Parrott leans on Harold, and Harold agrees to take the job, although he's not particularly happy about it. A few more years in Brooklyn, moved to California. Parrott has stuck with the job of laying out the Coliseum for the Dodgers, which is, of course, not built for baseball. But the ticket manager has to figure out what sections of the seats will cost what and how they will be differentiated and get the tickets printed and all that kind of thing. Complicated in the Coliseum by the fact that they decided that the Coliseum didn't have seats. The Coliseum had benches with numbers painted along the back of the benches. And they decided that the space between the numbers was too small. So they took out they pulled every fifth ticket, okay? And then somebody who had bought season tickets would get seats 102, 103, 105, 6, and 7, and of course would call up and say, where's my seat 104? And Parrott had to straighten all that out. Then he had to do it again at Dodger Stadium, which was easy because the stadium had been designed from the beginning with certain seats and prices in mind. In June of 1963, Harold Parrott's in an automobile accident. He's evidently quite bloodied up around the head. He returns to his house out in Malibu to recover. In August, 2 months later, the Dodgers announced that Parrott has asked for a leave of absence. Then the world goes silent until November, when he is hired by the Angels to be in season ticket sales and promotions. So it turns out Harold was fired. And when you ask Buzzy Bavese about it, he says it was similar to Jack Collins in the 50s. That's how Jack Collins gets in this story. Okay. In the book, Harold very cleverly says, not a ticket nor a dollar was found out of place. These guys were just after me, and O'Malley hated me, and he put this accountant on me, and he turned everything upside down, went through my private papers, and not a ticket nor a dollar was found out of place. Well, that's because he was doing something else. This is, again, quoting Bavese, and this is getting very much closer to the kind of thing that Collins evidently did, which was holding back blocks of primo seats until the ticket brokers, or the hotels in Parrott's case, would come as it appeared that a certain game was going to be highly popular. Then those tickets would be made available to the broker or the hotel, which could then sell them above cover price, and some division of the proceeds could take place. So it's kind of a gray area. If you just read what Buzzy says here at the bottom, it's almost like a tip or a gratuity for a service rendered. But when you get into the bigger thing, it's clear that at a minimum, he is kind of skimming money, and maybe even more than that. So for the rest of his career, he is in season ticket sales and promotions, first with the Angels. He goes for a big raise to the Pilots, which of course, as almost everything with the Pilots, turns out to be a mistake. He's fired not because of his performance, but because the Pilots can't afford him anymore and are circling the drain at this point already. And then Buzzy Bavese hires him a couple of months later, and he works for the Padres until he retires. However, I would note that he is no longer, even in these jobs, even though he stays in baseball, people are forgiving, he's not put in a position where he controls a cash box or the vault to the tickets anymore. So he writes the book, and the book is The Revenge of the Parrott. Everybody he ever worked for gets trashed. Bob Reynolds was called the horse because he was a 60-minute man for the Stanford football team in the late 1930s. The Cowboys, obvious, but the two gullibles is not. But that's how he characterizes his bosses. This is Dewey Soriano in Seattle. The second quote is particularly nice. and you know, merely makes him look like a shyster. And then this is one of my favorite parts. After trashing Soriano like that, we get the fact that Jim Boughton and his book are a cheap shot guy. So, and then his last employer is C. Arnhold Smith, who actually probably deserves these nicknames. And he wasn't limited to people he worked for. He worked for other people around baseball and managed to always come up with some derogatory nickname that or description that would stick with a guy. But he also began to do other things in the book beyond just negative nicknames. This is a one-page section of the book in which he describes how Gushy Bush deserves a dunce cap, okay? He buys the team. You could read that. He wants black players to boost attendance. This is in 1953. So they get a couple of black players, and they aren't that good. They just don't perform. And Bush begins to complain, these guys aren't that good. They don't win pennants. They keep whining. They keep asking for more money. So as a result, Harold says, Bush goes out and trades Curt Flood, Steve Carlton, and Jerry Royce. Now, all of you are out there calculating that Curt Flood was traded 15 years after the first one, and the other two were traded 18 years after, and there's no mentions of the two World Series wins or the three pennants in the interim. But that's the story. He's a dunce because he traded these guys after getting disappointed. He also begins to roll out other... When he has a story that it looks pretty clearly he has no real facts behind, he begins to report that cynics or gossips would say such and such a thing. And now the cynics or gossips are saying he's forcing Buzzy Bavezzi out of Los Angeles to make room for Peter O'Malley. Okay, well, Peter O'Malley wasn't going to do Bavezzi's job. Bavezzi was the GM. Peter O'Malley was going to run stadium operations. And that he's going to televise, he deliberately wants the San Diego operation to fail. So he's going to televise a lot of games into San Diego. And he does televise games into San Diego, the exact same number that he had previously televised of the Giants. The Dodgers had a very restrictive television policy in those years. They only televised the games at Candlestick Park. Now they would add the games of the other West Coast teams as well. And then he says O'Malley's real intention in all of this was that the San Diego franchise would fail and that he could then turn it into a pay television market for the Dodgers. Pay television had been outlawed in California 5 years earlier by a statewide plebiscite. But then he says he wouldn't do that thing. It's an ugly rumor and he'd never do that kind of thing. But, you know, it's really hard not to believe it when you want to. The selective use of facts could continue. As I said, he and O'Malley really didn't like each other, and he took his best shots at O'Malley. What we have here is his Parrott's description of the deal between O'Malley, in which he bought the Los Angeles Angels PCL franchise from Philip Wrigley in 1957. And he said all he did was con Wrigley into taking the Fort Worth franchise, lock, stock, and ballpark. Well, he did get a AAA franchise for a AA franchise, and he paid $3 million. But that's not in the book. So after looking into a number of these incidents and rereading the book, I started this looking for good anecdotes and quotes and things to use in my book about O'Malley, and then I got kind of squirrely after running into all of these stuff. So my conclusion to all of you who will undoubtedly be tempted by the book, take it with a grain of salt. There are some very good things in there. He's a nice writer. There are some funny stories. But I think you've got to be careful and look into the surroundings. Anyway, thank you very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Quick comment first. Not only did, I'm sure you know this, not only did Parrott write the columns for Leo, but when Leo was suspended, he goes through Leo's autobiography, The Dodgers and Me, which is a wonderful book that I highly recommend. But actually, listening to your talk, which I enjoyed very much, I'm amazed that he lasted as long as he did under O'Malley. particularly since many people have written that O'Malley wanted to get rid of anybody who was close to Ricky, including a couple of Hall of Famers, Red Barber and Jackie Robinson, who didn't last nearly as long as Parrott did.
They clearly didn't like each other. There are constant references in books by other people involved in the Dodgers in those years that he wanted to get rid of Parrott earlier on. But he didn't. And he had, a lot of what comes through about him is being very ruthless. On the other hand, he often didn't interfere with his subordinates. One of the very interesting things that Bavese told me is that, you know, there was a lot of tension between O'Malley and Robinson, two other people who didn't like each other. And O'Malley would hint, Bavese said, that Bavese should trade Robinson. And Bavese was perfectly confident to ignore that. You know, he ignored it for 6 years until he felt Robinson was over the hill. And then he traded him. So O'Malley gave his executives some leeway. And Parrott was clearly performing. Now, there were side benefits that O'Malley took a while to find out about. But he was willing to let Parrott stick around. And anyway, yeah, I appreciate your comment.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Yeah. I think a lot of it is forgive and forget. He was a guy, by that time he was close to 60. He had a family support. In some things he was very good. He was a terrific salesman. He was a terrific guy for promotions. For coming up with ideas that would sell more tickets, and as I said, he's then put in a position where he doesn't have access to a cash drawer, he doesn't have direct access to the tickets that he could use them. So Bavese is a very kind-hearted guy, and his reputation for doing favors for all kinds of people in baseball was enormous, and I think he saw an old colleague, a guy he'd worked with for 15 years, actually 20 years probably, and who needed a job, and he gave it to him. You know, but he also positioned him in certain ways that he couldn't hurt the organization. Anybody else?
When you interviewed Bavese, did you actually meet him?
Yeah, I went to his house twice for a long, multi-house. He had this incredible house in La Jolla, up on the ridge, where you can see the Pacific for, it felt like, 100 miles. It was just absolutely gorgeous. He made out well in the house market. Twice in the early 90s before he died. I had long sessions with him. Very helpful. Yeah, Anthony?
Is that book for sale somewhere?
I didn't plant him. I just want you to know. Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm supposed to go down right after this and sign copies at the Nebraska desk. So if any of you would like to buy 10, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Andy. Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much.